The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Hello and welcome to ILTV's Zion News and the Blaze Radio Network. Coming up in today's newscast, the IDF confirms a mix-up in yesterday's flare-up on the Gaza border. Prime Minister Netanyahu hails Israeli efforts that halted EU funding of NGOs. And they were only here for a few months, but now it looks like the Juul e-cigarettes are saying bye-bye to the Holy Land. The IDF has just admitted that yesterday's apparent attack by Hamas militants on Israeli soldiers was, as it turns out, misinterpreted. Army officials have now confirmed that a closed Hamas military drill was the actual source of yesterday's gunfire, mistakenly prompting an IDF retaliation. At least two Hamas operatives were killed in that counterattack. Though the IDF has reportedly admitted the error to both Hamas and Egypt amidst negotiations for a ceasefire deal, army officials say that their retaliation was still necessary, even if it was a drill. They point out that Hamas failed to alert the IDF that they were conducting a live-fire exercise. Given the tight proximity within the Gaza Strip, the gunfire was heard by IDF soldiers near the border. The real-time war scenario is a very crucial one, leading officers to conclude that their troops were under attack. Now, the army did justify its attack with video footage published to social media yesterday, accusing Hamas of striking first. Hamas, in turn, however, has released its own video, which appears to prove the opposite, likely forcing the IDF to admit their apparent mistake. Still, given Hamas's mission to wipe Israel off the face of the map, these war games can still be interpreted by many Israelis as an act of aggression in itself. But with all sides cautiously optimistic that some kind of ceasefire deal can yet be reached, miscommunications like these threaten to topple any such deal.
The first round of renewed United States sanctions against Iran are now in full effect. The first targets are Iran's exported goods like pistachios and rugs, but also on trade in aluminum and steel, airline and automotive equipment, U.S. currency, and more. Any businesses that deal with Iran may also find themselves losing the United States as a customer under these resumed penalties. So now, experts worldwide are waiting anxiously for Iran's response, and returning to the studio with the details is Lieutenant Colonel in the Reserves and expert on the Middle East from the Begin Sadat Center at Bar-Ilan University, Dr. Mordechai Kedar. Dr. Kedar, thank you so much for being back with us today. So first of all, you know, what are the possible scenarios? What are the outcomes that we're most likely to see with these re-implementation of sanctions?
Well, I think that first of all, we have to admit that the economy of Iran is actually in a collapse. The currency lost like 80% of its value during the last couple of months. People actually do not believe anymore in the currency and in the economy, and maybe in the regime as well. And this is what happens inside Iran. In my view, if the situation continues as it is, Iran is in a collapse between half a year from today and a year. That's all. Collapse.
Some of the recent protests that we've seen, I mean, they were smaller than we saw maybe a year ago.
No, people know. When you cannot feed your people, when you give them to drink, you are in a collapse. Whether people demonstrate or not, you cannot function as a state.
All right.
Now, there are two scenarios. One, that Iran will restart negotiations with the West. You know, maybe to come to a better term. Mm. It will be posed as a very nice thing by the United States, and now we will have a better. This is the worst thing. Why? Because those Iranians are experts in negotiations. They will drag the time, and they have only 2 years until Trump has to run again to presidency. They hope that he will not be re-elected. So they won the war. Means they passed 4 years with Trump and they succeeded to do whatever they like. Okay, it cost a little bit, but that's it. And this is the worst thing. What should be done to them is not talking even to them. To send them the list of demands to dismantle their nuclear program, to dismantle their missiles, to dismantle the factories of these missiles, to stop sabotaging Yemen and Syria and Iraq and take all the troops from them, and only then things can be maybe settled with all kinds of agreements.
But again, how, you know, let's say that Trump took all these demands right now to Iran, how likely would they be to take it, even in 6 months to a year, if their economy were to collapse?
That if the sanctions will be as extreme as they are now, they will have no other choice but to succumb to the demands. But it is conditioned that nobody sits with them and nobody talks to them. Just give everything. Just do what you are told. And this is what the regime knows. This regime will manipulate the whole world for as long as they can in order to get out of these sanctions.
Now, in a somewhat related matter, we know that Iran is funding different armies all over the world, including Hezbollah and Hamas. And Hamas right now is in negotiation talks for a ceasefire with Israel through Egypt and reconciliation talks with the PA. How is this going to affect everything?
Everything which Hamas is doing today is because of what happens in Iran. Because Hamas know that the days which Iran still supports them are numbered.
Because especially with their economy the way it is.
Exactly. And there are voices in those demonstrations. Stop supporting Hamas. Stop supporting Lebanon, means Lebanon. Start taking care of Iran. That's what the people say in the streets. And they know in Gaza that the end of the Iranian support is already in the foreseeable future. This is why they are in such a pressure to come to any agreement with Israel, especially long truce with Israel, ceasefire. And this is, again, the worst thing. Why? Imagine that Israel signs with them a 5-year long truce. Mm-hmm. Okay? What happens if we find out after a month from the signing that they actually are building a new missile factory,
sure,
which will produce missiles which can reach all the way from Elat in the south to Metula in the north, sure, including Tel Aviv, Dimona, and all that? What are we supposed to do then? To sit with handcuffs for 4.5 years only because we signed some stupid, sure, agreement with Hamas? Hamas again. Israel actually should resume its deterrence vis-a-vis Hamas. And this is the whole thing. To threaten them day and night. And this, no negotiations, nothing. This is how the Middle East functions, unfortunately. But whoever tries to function here in the Middle East like a European,
sure,
ends, so where.
All right. Professor Dr. Kidal, thank you so much for coming
thank
back.
Thank you so much.
And sharing your insights with us. A bombshell report from Israeli media has accused the government of funding an institute that illegally seized a Palestinian home in the West Bank. Financial records recovered from the institute in question seem to confirm that Israel's culture ministry has been granting annual stipends of roughly $50,000 per year. By now, the total amount of money paid out is close to $250,000.
The institute in question is an Israeli religious organization known as Mishpate Eretz. The group was originally founded in the year 2000 by the chief rabbi of the Jewish Ofra settlement in the West Bank, and over the years, it's frequently been accused of illegally seizing Palestinian-owned land using forged documents. The most recent case involves a decades-long dispute over a Palestinian home near Ofra. The Al-Watan company, apparently operating on behalf of Mishpate Eretz, claims they purchased the building from the 5-member Palestinian Shahada family in 2003, a buy that prompted Jewish members of Mishpate Eretz to move in. But according to the Shahada family, the family had taken their kids to see a doctor in Ramallah and upon returning, discovered a group of Jewish settlers in their homes carrying weapons, claiming that the building was now theirs. This erupted into a long legal dispute. In the end, the courts ultimately sided with the Palestinian family upon discovering that the settlers' purchase documents and contracts were all apparently falsified. Furthermore, though a representative claimed to have had lengthy meetings with the Shahadas at least twice to discuss contracts, he was unable to identify even one member of the family in court. The judge ruled that the building be returned to the Palestinian owners, but 10 days after the verdict, the IDF seized the land anyway, built a fence around it, and closed it down for unspecified security purposes. To this day, the Jewish settlers remain in the building and have apparently been receiving state funds ever since. News of the Israeli government's alleged funding of this group and its operations has been met with fierce anger from NGOs working on behalf of Palestinians. For them, this amounts to a long-held policy of illegally seizing land for Jewish expansion in the West Bank. But others see it as Israel's duty to claim this land for religious purposes at any cost. Neither the state nor representatives from any settlement groups have offered any comment at this time.
Prime Minister Netanyahu has just made an announcement that has caught many by surprise. According to the Prime Minister, he has successfully convinced the EU to halt funding to the left-wing organization called the Freedom Protection Council. Now, the EU has somewhat refuted that claim, saying that no final decision has yet been made. But if Netanyahu's words are true, then this would be a rare occasion where Europe has accepted an Israeli request like this. ILTV's Brett Allen Smith is here with more. And Brett, first off, tell me about this council.
Sure. So the Freedom Protection Council is basically kind of like a co-op, right, between several prominent left-wing NGOs. Some of them are Israeli, some of them are foreign. The council itself was founded by an Arab-Israeli group called Elam, which campaigns for what they say is freedom of the media. But the council also includes groups like B'Tselem and Adala, which we've talked about, and those have both been frequently targeted by the Israeli government due to their criticism of Israeli policy in the occupied Palestinian territories. B'Tselem teaches Palestinians how to use digital cameras so that they can film and publish alleged human rights violations that happen in the territories. But the Israeli government has long accused these groups and this council, in fact, of undermining Israel's mere right to exist to begin with. On the other hand, these groups would argue that they're basically only trying to protect civil rights and liberties and expose human rights violations. Now, the EU has promised to allocate over 360,000 euros to this council until December of 2019, which kind of brings us to today.
Okay, so yeah, so that brings us to Netanyahu's announcement then that that he somehow convinced Europe to halt those funds. And European leaders have typically denied any Israeli request to stop funding these NGOs. And that's exactly one of Israel's biggest criticisms of the EU in the first place. They say it amounts to foreign countries basically meddling in other countries' affairs.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because by now, you know, the EU has largely paid out that amount of money already to this that initially pledged to that council. And furthermore, the council's activities are quite separate from the individual activities of those individual NGO groups who operate in the territories like B'Tselem and Adala. But if what Netanyahu is saying is true, it would mean that Europe maybe is reconsidering that policy. I mean, it could just as easily mean, though, that, you know, maybe they're just going to submit those same funds to the same places through, you know, different channels. Like this amount of money, for example, that would more than make up for the missing funds from the UN's Palestinian Refugee Agency after Trump cut those U.S. funds to to UNRWA. One thing is for sure, though, Europe has a lot of attention and money probably still invested in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And for now, no final word has been made as far as the EU's concerned, as far as the Freedom Protection Council goes. So there's still a lot we don't know, I gotta say.
All right, well, Netanyahu says that this halt of these funds is merely the beginning, if it's true to begin with, of course. So I suppose, as always, we can only wait and see.
Right.
Thanks for the info, Brett.
Of course.
Israeli arts and designers are amazing, but there are just too many of them to keep track of on our own. And that's why it's so fortunate that Israeli art magazine Kan compiles the best and brightest in Israel's art scene for us. Joining me now with more is the editor of the Kan Israeli Art Magazine, Chana Barak Engel. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me. I'm the editor of the magazine. Mm-hmm. The producer is by ICU, which is an artist organization.
Okay.
And the magazine is existing since 2007. The first issue actually was out in 2008. I'm doing this job about 5 years, in the last 5 years. I do enjoy it very much. We cover the Israeli art world, everything which is happening at the real time. Mm-hmm. Which is not so easy.
Yeah. So what's the principal purpose of this magazine? What's your main message, I suppose, that you want to show?
We don't have message. The main reason we exist it's to cover the Israeli art scene.
Okay.
The museums, the galleries. Sometimes I visit an artist studio without any exhibition. Just because he's very interesting or he has something special to say. So I'm going and visit and make some article about it. And we cover Israeli artists abroad too.
Yeah. All right, so you know, what are some of the upcoming events that you're covering in this in the magazine, this issue?
Most of the events.
Some of the big ones.
Yes. Well, the Tel Aviv Museum, of course. A lot of very interesting things happening there. A lot of interesting things happening in Yavne, which is in the periphery. We don't always pay enough attention to the outside of Tel Aviv. We're looking only at what happened here. And the Israeli Museum in Jerusalem is very interesting too. They try to get to a new venue in these days. I hope it will be successful. I really, really hope they will show much more Israeli artists. I do believe that they exist to expose Israeli artists, not only foreign ones.
Where is your magazine available? Is there an online issue for people who'd like to read online?
Barely, only a small part of it, since as you can see, we still use the paper for print.
Sure. So where is it available to purchase?
In the museum shops, of course, for people who sign up. In the well, we have it about two. In the many of the universities in the United States, in the MoMA, we start to contribute in Europe lately. We have already several places in Germany and other countries, and we keep going with.
All right. Well, I can't wait to get my hands on it. I want to. Maybe I'll be in it one day. That'd be fun, huh? I don't know what I'll do.
That might be very interesting.
I'll do something very cool. I'll do something very artistic, and you'll be like, "Wow!"
Okay, let me know.
All right, Hannah. Thank you so much for coming in and sharing.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, and see you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
More than a decade ago, an incredible relic of Christian archaeology was discovered in the most unlikely of places, beneath an Israeli prison. The prison happened to be located next to the ancient ruins of Megiddo, and Christian theology predicts that Megiddo is the place where the final battle, the apocalypse, will be fought by the forces of good and evil. Well, after years of red tape, the Israeli government has finally decided to move the prison so that the site can be further excavated, and hopefully shared with the public in the very near future.
You know, when the Christian prayer hall was first found beneath the prison, we were all excited for 1 minute. And then we realize, oh, it's in a maximum security prison, so we'll never actually be able to do anything with it. Now that the government has decided to move this prison, we can now explore this really amazing and interesting part of the development of early Christianity in a way we didn't think we'd be able to.
Now, this site was discovered completely by accident back in 2005 when the prison was undergoing an expansion. Archaeologists immediately realized that they had a potentially historic find on their hands, the ruins of a 3rd century Christian prayer hall adorned with a mosaic that mentioned God Jesus Christ. It took running through a lot of bureaucracy given the sensitive nature of this prison and its inmates, but finally the government's given the green light to keep the dig going.
Ma'avirim kele shel 1000 asirim mesukanim bebonim mitcham chadash kedei lachsof et hapsifas ve'la'asher לאנשים מכל העולם לבוא וליהנות מהממצא הארכיאולוגי המדהים שהתגלה בזכות זה שרצינו פשוט להרחיב את הבית הסוהר. אחרת, אף אחד לא היה יודע פה שיש פסיפס.
Needless to say, this is a crucial discovery that could illuminate all kinds of secrets in Christian theology. A mystery only deepened by the site's presence on the outskirts of Megiddo, where believers believe the decisive battle of Armageddon will one day be waged.
Megiddo was important because it sits on the international road which connects Egypt with Mesopotamia, with Damascus, with Anatolia. So whoever sits here controls the most important road of antiquity in the ancient world. Megiddo is also important because it is mentioned by all great archives of the ancient Near East and many times in the Bible. And it is the key for understanding almost every issue that relates to the history, archaeology, and history of the Bronze and Iron Ages, including many themes that are related to biblical history.
If you've ever been to the Holy Land, and more specifically to Tel Aviv, you've probably noticed a lot of people still smoke cigarettes, whether it's at the beach, at the coffee shop, or just walking down the street. Well, the new trend, at least in the States, is the electronic cigarette and the brand Juul. But Juul is getting into a bit of hot water here in Israel, at least, as it has in the States. And ILTV's Emmanuel Kadosh is here with the latest details. Emmanuel, what is Israel's e-cig situation?
Thanks, Aaron. Like you said, the rules of, you know, where you can smoke and can't smoke in Israel are a lot, and I mean a lot more lenient than those of the States. So you can and most likely will see people, like you said, on the streets and more specifically in public places smoking. But the e-cig trend has made its way over to Israel just last May when the San Francisco-based Juul Labs Incorporation began operating. Now, I'm sure for all our viewers in the States, they've seen at least one or two people walking around holding this matte black, slick, USB-looking device in their hands constantly. Well, apparently this move did not sit well with the Israeli Ministry of Health, which has decided to ban Juul's marketing here in Israel.
All right, so I definitely agree with you on one thing, and that's the last time I was in the States, I had trouble finding many people who didn't own or at least try an e-cigarette.
Yeah.
But if Israel is afraid of them, you know, why are they banning the marketing only of Juul rather than Juul itself?
Right. So the decision to ban the marketing of Juul is now just waiting for the final approval stamp from Israel's attorney general. And when I hear more about the reasoning behind this, I don't, you know, completely disagree. I mean, the Juul itself comes with colorful nicotine pods in different flavors, and each pod contains something like twice the amount of nicotine that's found in most brands of e-cigs. But that's not even, you know, the main issue here. Beyond that, Juul states that they are, you know, an alternative for already existing adult smokers, yet the company has been criticized, you know, insanely for its fast-growing popularity with teenagers specifically. So if you ask me, I'm more than positive that that's, you know, the right reason they want to ban the marketing.
Okay, so first of all, I did not know that each pod had that much nicotine, honestly.
Crazy amount.
Yeah, the way I see people smoking these things, it's crazy to think about how much nicotine they're taking in.
You would think it was just vapor. You wouldn't even realize.
Right.
Yeah.
And I definitely see teens, not just in the States, but here in Israel too, smoking these electronic cigarettes, just like in the commercial, you know,
exactly,
that we saw.
Exactly. The issue with the teens getting a hold of this Juul is that some people say that the Juul is marketing the product as safe. So when kids see a safe smoking option and they notice that all the adults are smoking this thing, they're going to assume everything's cool and everything's okay and that they can do it, when in reality, they are highly addictive. The Juul itself and obviously, you know, the nicotine that comes along with it, it's a crazy dosage of nicotine. So, you know, when they're marketing with the flashy colors and the pods and the options and the different ways that you can design it, it's...
Yeah, it's definitely supposed to look, you know, new and...
Right.
It's young. It's hip, it's fresh.
It's hip, it's fresh, and it's not fresh.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, people just get stuck to certain trends that they see happening without really being fully informed the way that they should be.
Yeah.
You know, we see that especially in random web challenges like the Kiki challenge, by the way, gone wrong.
Totally wrong.
So this has gone very wrong. So maybe the ban on marketing for Juul isn't the worst idea in the world. And if not, at least educate the teens on the effect of nicotine and explain that this is not a safe or less harmful smoking solution.
This isn't a solution,
Right. Safe is a relative term anyway.
Exactly.
Anyway, so I guess we'll be looking out for more updates. Thanks, Manuel.
Thank you.
61-year-old Shlomi Lazmi tragically lost his eyesight 32 years ago while serving in the IDF's reserves. But this incredible Israeli vet didn't let his blindness get in the way of a very promising athletic career. Quite the opposite, actually. In fact, for the second year in a row, Lazmi has just snagged the gold medal in the World Bowling Championships for the blind, making him indisputably the best blind bowler in the world.
This year's 10-pin bowling world championship match was held in Prague, where Lazmi beat out both Japan and Poland for the gold. Blind bowling, in case you're wondering, is very much like the sport's typical iteration in almost every way. Bowlers simply use a sighted guidance method to help position them on the alley, or they can use a guide rail to help them aim. But other than that, the rest is pretty much the same. No bumpers, no special pins, nothing. Now, for most of us, bowling is, well, a tricky sport that combines technique with patience, skill, precision, and endurance. Lazmi cleared over 120 points in both of his winning matches, which is very impressive. I think most of us, like myself, are jumping for joy if we can even clear 100. But Lazmi is more than just a bowler. He was actually also on Israel's Paralympic goalball team, which is a modified form of soccer for the blind. Needless to say, his accomplishments, perseverance, and love of the game is something we can all look up to. And you can guarantee that next year, Lazmi will be heading back to the championships to see if the third time is also a charm. The Hebrew Word of the Day is brought to you by IDC Samru Ulpan, open to everyone.
Now our Hebrew Word of the Day, Israeli athlete Shlomi Lazmi is officially the world's best blind bowler. So in honor of his dual gold medals, today's word is lesachek bowling, which is how you say to play bowling here in Hebrew. Now, I'm not going to lie, every time I misachek bowling or bowl, I feel pretty lucky just keeping my kadul bowling or bowling ball out of the gutter and out of other people's lanes. Now, some people absolutely love to lesachek bowling, others absolutely hate to lesachek bowling. But at the end of the day, I think we can at least all agree that we hate those shoes you gotta wear when you misachek bowling. They're never, ever, ever available in the right size. Now let's take a look at the weather forecast. Tonight should be partly cloudy and warm with a low of 79 or 26 degrees Celsius. Then tomorrow you can expect clear to partly cloudy skies and a slight rise in temperatures to a high of 89 or 32 degrees Celsius.